State School Superintendent Susan Castillo, who is with us today to give us an overview on school finance. And I see you brought some of your staff people with you, so come forward and bring your friends or however you care to do this. Welcome to the Revenue Committee. We're glad to have you.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Susan Castillo, Superintendent of Public Instruction for the State of Oregon. Thank you so much for this opportunity to talk with you this morning. And I have a very simple, I suspect, predictable message, and that is that our public schools need the help of the Revenue Committee and wanted to address that this morning. I just wanted briefly, if I could, just sort of go over paint the picture about what is happening with our public schools today and the situation that they're in today, and then talk about some revenue-raising proposals that I know you have all been looking at or considering and express support for some of the things that, that are for your consideration. For the last 12 years, as you all know, we have been demanding more from our schools and giving them less. And amazingly, our schools have been meeting our demands. We've established high standards for what students need to know and to be able to do in math and science and in reading and writing. We've developed assessments to determine if students were meeting those standards. We are created a new way of measuring what students can do and what they know. And we've asked our schools and especially our teachers to adjust those standards and those assessments. And they have delivered. More and more of our students are meeting our standards. The percentage of eighth graders are meeting the reading standard has gone from 41% in 1990 to 64% in 2001. The percentage of 10th graders meeting standards for math problem solving has gone from 23% in 1996 to 50% in 2001. And of course, we continue to have among the highest SAT scores in the nation. And Oregonians should know that around this country, we are held up as a model for what we've been doing on setting our goals and measuring progress towards those goals. And now the federal government is telling all states that they need to do what Oregon has been doing with our standards and assessments. The new federal law is telling all schools that they have to implement what we have been doing here for years. And I should note that in addition to having accountability in terms of student performance, in addition to our student assessments and our state report card, we also have had real accountability in terms of how dollars are spent. We have better data today that really helps us track what we are doing with those education dollars. Thanks to the database initiative, you can go online and see in great detail how school districts are spending the money that we give them. And we have before you, we provided samples of what you can find on the web for districts in your part of the state. And we can get you whatever copies you would like on other districts that are in your district. Meanwhile, we've been demanding and getting better performance and adopting accountability measures, but we've been giving less to our schools. And I know you've seen seven different ways of calculating per pupil spending, and that can be confusing, but we do have a very good study by Eco Northwest, which I know that this committee has seen, which does a great job of comparing oranges to oranges and makes an effort to explain the differences between the numbers. And I just wanted to highlight a few facts that are in that report. Eco Northwest points out that in 1990, we were spending 4.6 of our total state income on K through 12 education. In 2000, we spent only 4.2%. So we're spending a smaller percentage of our money on schools now than we did in 1990. And if you adjust spending per pupil for the increase in the number of kids who are more costly to teach, the increased numbers of English language learners with more and more different languages represented, and the increased number of students with special needs, many with extreme special needs, then by any measure, spending is not kept up with the need in our schools. And if you keep in mind that education is very labor-intensive, that workers need health care coverage, and that health care costs rise more rapidly than regular inflation, it's clear that the money has not kept up with the need in our schools. So how is it that schools have managed to do more with less? Well, I think the answer is largely focus and effort. When you give people goals to strive for and standards to meet, they will generally respond by doing their best to meet them, and that's what's happened in our schools. The legislature set the standards. Our schools have striven to meet them, and that has overcome the lack of funding. But focus and effort can take you only so far. And we are now about to take a quantum leap. We in the federal government are demanding dramatic improvements from our schools, and it appears we are about to give them dramatically less money than they need. And it's as if we were telling a baseball manager, win 100 games and the series this year, or you're fired. And by the way, you've got to cut payroll by 20%. Well, I am very concerned about how this is going to work. We as a state have set a goal of 90% of students meeting our standards. The federal government in the No Child Left Behind Act has told us that all children should be able to meet our standards. We can't expect that to work without a significant additional investment in our schools. We can be pretty confident that as we try to move from 64% of eighth graders meeting reading standards to 90 or 100%, we're dealing with kids who need a bit more help, more individual attention, somewhat better trained teachers, and we're not going to reach those kids unless we reduce class size and improve teacher training. We have a model that estimates what kind of schools we need to have to achieve our 90% goal, the quality education model, and I know this committee is very familiar with it. That model tells us that the cost of reducing class sizes, improving professional development, and taking the other steps that we need to meet our goals would be, in the next biennium, $6.9 billion. Instead, the governor's current budget has proposed $5 billion, and that's $1 billion less. Let me repeat, $1 billion less than it would take simply to maintain schools at the level they started in this current biennium, making reasonable adjustments for enrollment growth, health care costs, PERS costs, and other factors. So that means layoffs, shortened school years, pay cuts, higher class sizes. And if we, as we fear, the actual numbers will be significantly less than $5 billion, is what the latest talk is in this building. That means lots of layoffs, lots of lost school days, huge class sizes, which would truly undermine the promise of public education in the state of Oregon to our children. And although our schools will continue to do all they can, as they always have, I don't think it's realistic to expect that we will continue to make the same kind of gains we have in the past 12 years that we are so proud of. So yes, I hope the Revenue Committee is going to consider raising some revenue this session. And I'm going to give you some suggestions to look at and that I support, that I know that are under your consideration. But before I do that, I think it's important to go after some of the misperceptions that many people have about school finance in this state. One misperception is that we're spending more than ever on schools and not getting much of a return on our investment. That is absolutely not true. As I said before, we are getting a return. Achievement is up, and by any measure, reasonable measure, we are not spending more. Another misperception is that we send money to schools and then we don't know where the money goes. As I said, that is incorrect. The database initiative provides detailed information online about how each school district spends its resources. Another misperception is that somehow, to the extent that we do know where it goes, it all goes to administration, and this is absolutely not true. According to the Secretary of State's audit, 8% of the budget goes to administrators, principals, vice principals, superintendents, and their staff, and that level is a pretty reasonable level for administration. However, the audit did show that 5% of school spending went to a category labeled business support, and that's the human resources departments. It's information technology and services and things like that. The audit showed that our spending in this category seems higher than the national average. So we're taking a serious look at that category. And one of the things we're doing is putting together a task force of information technology officers around the state to see if there are ways to improve service and save resources by adopting common technology systems. So there may be ways to save a bit of money on administration, but it's not a lot. And it's not by any means a way that we can solve our school funding problems. Another misperception is that we are somehow spending hundreds of millions of dollars on SIM and CAM. Well, this is not true. COSA recently did a survey, and the Department of Education did a study that showed that in terms of actual cash plus the time of teachers and other personnel who would continue to exist even if there were no SIMONCAM, the cost of having this assessment system in place is in the $30 to $50 million biennium range. As a quality assurance budget for a $5 billion investment in K-12, $30 to $50 million is not extravagant, and the vast majority of those expenses are in effect required by the No Child Left Behind Act. And a final misperception is, in some circles, is that the federal No Child Left Behind Act made lots of new money available. Well, that's not the case. The Act has noble goals, but the method the federal government has chosen to implement them relies more on the stick than on the carrot. The state and schools will lose money if we don't comply. As of today, there isn't a whole lot of help from the federal government with the implementation of that very large mandate. Well, all of us want a statewide solution to our school funding problem, and I believe that the surprisingly strong showing of Measure 28, I know some people don't see it that way, indicates that we may be closer to that statewide solution than anyone thought. But as we stand today, it may be the only chance some schools have to survive this storm is to expand the local option. And I understand that this committee may support a local option proposal, and I would support such a proposal, although, as I said, I believe that we need a statewide solution. I would also like to see the committee consider a range of other revenue-raising options to increase the amount available in the school funding formula and thus help all schools. And I'm not suggesting that the committee should adopt all of the measures that I'm going to talk about, but that they could be temporary solutions. And I do think that they do deserve serious consideration, especially in these very serious times for our state and our schools. Some people have proposed evaluating our tax expenditures, and particularly tax breaks for corporate income and personal income. And I agree that this is worth considering. I recognize that many of our tax exemptions and subtractions are quite defensible as a matter of policy, but when we're cutting important state services, the tax expenditures cannot avoid scrutiny right now. Some have proposed asking the people who are still doing well in this weak economy to make a contribution, temporarily raising the income tax rate on people who make over $200,000 to 11%. California did something very similar in 1991, and Governor Gray Davis has proposed that again this year. It would raise $295 million in the next biennium. And again, I'm not suggesting this as a permanent solution by any means, but I think in a crisis, it is, I think that we should consider asking those who are getting very generous tax breaks from the federal government to make a contribution. And I would add that you might consider, as the House Democrats have suggested, a temporary tax to cut for families making under $35,000 in order to get money into the hands of those who need it most and are most likely to stimulate the economy by spending it. Some have proposed equalizing the tax rate on corporate profits, which is now 6.6%, with a 9% top rate on personal income. Again, that is just a tax on profits, and again, I think that one is also worth considering as a temporary solution. The Oregonian and the Register Guard have recommended reducing video poker commissions for taverns in accordance with two audits performed in 1994. Again, I think that's worth considering. I would recommend that you invite economist Joe Courtwright, who conducted one of the 1994 studies, to testify before your committee and go through his findings, which I think are still very relevant today. And as I said, again, I'm not suggesting that you should immediately or permanently adopt all of these proposals, but I do think that they deserve very serious consideration in these very trying times. When we're cutting services, tax expenditures, and video poker commissions should not escape scrutiny. When so many are suffering, I don't think it's unreasonable to ask for a contribution from corporations and individuals who are still doing well. I know you will hear other suggestions to raise revenue and that you'll also hear new ideas about tax cuts. When you hear those proposals, there's something that I would like to ask you to remember. Every $1 million pays for a year's education for well over 100 kids. So when someone says, you can afford a tax break because it's only $10 million, or that you should reject a revenue increase because it's only $10 million. Please keep that in mind. I promise you that we will continue to leave no stone unturned in looking for efficiencies in education. We will work with our partners to see how we can save money. But we've all been turning over stones for over a year, and we are not going to find $1 billion or more under the next stone. It would be much more convenient for all of us if there were a nice, simple solution to our school funding problems. It would be nice if the federal government would step up and help us, especially with No Child Left Behind, so we could solve all of our problems. Or if PERS would just address the huge deficit that we have in school funding, or cutting administration, or getting rid of Sim and Cam. If those were just the simple solutions that we could do to address the shortfall for schools. But it's not. Unfortunately, it's not going to be that easy. We do need a serious consideration of some solutions that are going to raise more revenue to help our schools so that we can continue to create more success for more kids as we have been doing. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you. For your testimony, questions or comments, reflections on the superintendent's testimony, Representative Parr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony, Superintendent. I met with the Eugene District 4J School Board last night, and a couple of interesting things came out of that, the conversation I had with those folks. It is pretty common knowledge in this building in particular and throughout the state that our schools are doing very, very well as far as delivering a top-rate education to our students. And it continues to be good even in the face of the budgetary problems that we've had since Measure 5 was passed. But one thing that was pointed out to me last night is that the superior education may be a cyclical thing. That is to say that the kids who were in the school system pre-Measure 5 are now graduating. And so we're going to be at a point where the kids in high school are all post-Measure 5 kids. And it's not out of the question that the lack of the classroom size and the other program cuts that occurred since Measure 5 could have an effect on the kids that are beginning to graduate, and we may indeed see the quality of our education show signs of deterioration because of what's happened. That's just a point that I wanted to make, that we shouldn't sit back complacently saying we're doing a great job with the kids, because if we continue to degrade our public education system, we're not going to continue to do a good job with the kids. So it is important that we strive for efficiencies where we can, and that we make a point of prioritizing education as one of our main goals in terms of how we spend the money that we raise. Thank you again for your testimony, Susan.
Thank you.
Other comments, questions? Representative Burchard.
Thank you. I want to thank you very much for coming with suggestions. That had been a criticism of mine when Brian was here, and I appreciate very much your coming with
him. He heard you when he went back and brought
him. He did.
He did. Boss.
He says she wants to hear what you think. I want to make some comments. I'm just going to kind of slip through here. On No Child Left Behind, where that is an unfunded mandate, aren't you legally not responsible for a while? Now, I don't mean forever. But you made the comment that you actually would lose money if you did not comply. I need to have you explain that to me. Would you like to do that now, and then I'll move further on in your text?
Absolutely. Mr. Chair, Representative Verger. Yes, federal dollars. We could lose federal dollars if we don't comply with this federal law. And so I guess what I would say is there, the one thing about the law, it has very, very demanding timelines, very short timelines for all the states. And I just returned from Washington, D.C., was at a meeting with my peers from around the country, superintendents from all over the country, and we had a meeting at the White House. We also met with U.S. Department officials. They are very pleased that all of the states work so hard to meet their January 31st deadline for getting our plans in, the first big deadline that all of the states had to meet. They were very pleased that we are all working very, very hard to meet the very short timelines of this law. But all of us across the country are really struggling with how do we do this without some extra help, and express that, you know, at every opportunity with the federal government, federal officials. And in those discussions, did not talk a lot about sending us more money, but did talk about trying to work with us on flexibility and trying to address the needs of each individual state as we implement this law. And so we are looking forward to continuing to have good conversations with federal officials about what we're doing here in Oregon. And by the way, they are very impressed with what Oregon is doing. We had a very positive meeting with Undersecretary Eugene Hickok and his staff, and they are very, very pleased with what we've been doing with our standards and assessments. And when we talk to them about some of the issues that are underway in this legislative session in Oregon, he was very interested in coming out here himself to communicate with legislators about his impressions about what they see Oregon doing with our standards and assessment system that we have in place, and how well it fits in with No Child Left Behind. So, yes, but back to the resource issue, very tight deadlines new requirements, reporting requirements, and the threat of losing federal funds if we don't comply with this big law.
If I can add, just in follow-up on that, it's not just the No Child Left Behind federal dollars that are at risk. Is it all federal funding that's at risk if we fail to comply?
Well, it would be our Title I dollars, and I'm trying to think of other... it's like I keep hearing the figure of $400 million in federal funds.
Okay. You know, I guess that that's a very lofty goal, and I don't object to that. I think we have lofty goals. We don't want anyone to go to prison. We want everybody to be healthy. We don't want any child to be left behind. And I think all those. The reality is that you're never going to totally achieve that goal. But I guess what I really don't like is the federal government sending unfunded mandates down and then threatening you with other money. I don't appreciate it from the federal government to the state. I don't appreciate it from the state to the locals. So having said that, we have another issue that you didn't touch on in your text, and that is declining enrollment versus growth schools. And their challenges are very different. With the declining enrollment, the schools are losing money, and yet they have a certain amount of overhead. So I think that, of course, speaking from my district, which the schools are declining, the SIM and CAM, I have shared this with you before, but also I continue to have people say that teachers, students, people within the educational community who are critical of it, not so much critical that it costs money, critical that it is a focus of time that they don't see truly benefits the students. I haven't heard that from my own district, and I hope that you took note that Marshfield High School was honored by the fact that their students make very good grades when they go to college, and we're really proud of that. Let's get to some of your solutions, because I think that that's important that we have that discussion. And 62% of the people in my district voted against Measure 28, ballot Measure 28. So consequently, in reflecting with my population of people, I have to look at ways that I can perhaps bring more money in for revenue. And the debate about the operational aspects of schools is very important and is, I think, somewhat delayed in the building, not because of revenue, not because of our committee, but just the general discussion of how we're really going to fund schools and over a longer period of time. Some of yours do talk to short-term solutions. One that I like is that those who can afford to support schools, and I'm not sure you're going to find objections from that, but in the last 01 session, I know that I tried to get the ballot measure to reflect over $100,000, and I could not get agreement on that. So I don't know whether you'll have an uphill climb. For whatever reason, people don't want to raise taxes. And we have almost a flat tax, 5, 7, and 9. Doesn't take too much money before you're getting to 9. I like lowering the tax on the lower end and raising the tax on the upper end. I think it makes sense, and I think Argonians would go with it. You have to be careful about taxing corporations more in this environment. You don't want to do anything to take away from jobs and job stimulus. And as far as other suggestions, I think you had several very good ones, and I don't want to go into them in detail. But what about salaries? Do you think that schools are going to be willing to freeze salaries, or what effort will the school community make to show people that they too are willing to share in the pain that we're going to go through?
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, I think we've already seen, Portland with teachers agreeing to work 10 days for free. That is a huge commitment to try to help with the current situation. In the Salem School District, we've seen teachers also in their settlement. They stepped up and are really doing what they can to help with the situation. I think we are seeing teachers, as we have for years, try to help with the current shortfalls in their school districts. And so I think that all around the state, as we see the negotiations move forward and communities deal with their individual situations for their school districts, that I think we are seeing teachers at the table making concessions and working with their school boards on how they address the very serious budget situations that districts all over the state are facing. So I think I think that we have seen teachers around Oregon stepping up and doing what they can to help us with the current situation. But I don't think that this situation should be put on the backs of teachers. I think we all need to work together to find a solution. This isn't, I don't think we should point to any particular group of professionals or, I think it's, our schools are underfunded. Our schools don't have the revenue that they need. That's the issue. It's not asking people to work for less or work for free or make more sacrifices. It's about all of us deciding, what do we want for public education in the state of Oregon, and are we willing to get to work towards getting that and giving our schools the resources they need to create success for kids? And that's how I look at it, is that we're all in this together. We all have a role to play in finding a solution, and it's not just the teachers who should be asked to take less or work for free. It's all of us working together on a solution.
One follow-up.
Sure.
I agree. I don't want to fund education on the backs of teachers doing without. They are our important resource for our children. They're the people that see them every day. I think that what we need to do, though, is to look at the public's perception. Maybe not yours or mine, but to look at the public's perception. In my district, there is a political reality that people don't want to combine schools. And let's take the North Bend, Coos Bay situation, where you have superintendents, staffs, ESDs, and people look at it from a business standpoint, and they want to add and subtract, and they say, we could save a lot of money, and we could just merge these schools. The political reality is that it maybe will never occur, but the criticism comes from the business aspect of the community, and I try to listen closely to that and to what people perceive, because basically you and I know perception is everything. Thank you.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you. Other committee members, comments, questions, reflections? Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I welcome you here today, and nice to see you. As someone who has been involved in this arena in the past, pre-Measure 5, and sat on a school board and listened a lot to this perceived criticism of our school system, I'm I'm always amazed that it never goes away. Everything that I heard 12 years ago, serving on a board, about how our schools have too much, there's too much administration, we're not at basics, we're funding things we shouldn't be funding, is still very, very much with us. And I agree with the representative that until we get somehow beyond some of that for some critical mass, no matter how we move to support schools, we're back with, oh, you're just giving them away. You're just giving away more. Do you have any thoughts on how to move away from that I've struggled with for so long I'm beginning to lose energy in the fight?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger. I guess what I would say is I think I absolutely agree with what you just said. I don't believe that we have done a good enough job, and I guess I would say the education system, or I think maybe state government in general, about making the connection about what people are paying for and what they get back for that investment, and giving really good information to the public. I think that we are at a point where we have better information than we ever have had on how we spend our dollars, and being able to help people get access to that information as we never have before. We have better data on to help make better policy decisions on what we do on education. We have better information about what works, what creates success for kids, and are able to use that data to help us make better decisions today. And we have a more data-driven education system. But you're absolutely right. The Oregon Business Council currently has a fabulous communications campaign that they have been working on to help us with this exact issue. How do we connect with the public, help them understand the successes and the winning program that we have in today's schools, so that when we ask them to make those investments in public education, they know that they're backing a winner? I think what happens today is the public hears so much about the negative things that are happening, the shortened school years, the teacher layoffs, the huge budget crisis that we have, that those positive messages are having a very difficult time breaking through those kinds of headlines and that kind of coverage. And we really do need a statewide communications effort to help people understand that we are creating more success for more kids. More kids are going to college than ever before as they leave our system. Test scores are up, I mean, we have a lot to be very proud of here in our state. And so that is one of my goals as superintendent, is to help with that communication, to get the word out about the fact that we have a winning program to invest in. And I use this example, when the Oregon Ducks became this winning football team, the money started pouring into that program. People like backing a winner, and we need to let them know that we have a winner to back in our public schools in Oregon. And because if all they ever hear are the negative stories about what's happening with school closures and shortened school years, they're going to say, why do I want to invest more in that? And we need to let them know we have a winning program to invest in. And so I am ready to partner with everyone around the state who wants to get engaged in helping me with that message and helping to connect people with the information about what's really going on in public schools today, and the fact that we can be very proud of the amazing success that we have in spite of how difficult the budgets have been for schools all over the state.
I agree with everything you said, and I applaud folks who are willing to come forward. I would make one word of caution, and that is that instead of talking about shortened school days and those kinds of problems, what we need to address with Oregonians is, are we educating our young people for jobs? Are they getting jobs? Are they able to pass standards at a higher rate? Are they learning? Because what the public sees a lot are the ones that aren't, the ones that are a problem, the ones that aren't successful, that become part of another system. Then we're cost shifting a lot of that too right now in terms of the corrections department and that. So I would caution you to be very proactive about talking about how our kids do succeed, and our successes with children who may not have been perceived as having a good background for success, and how we can turn them around. That's what we need to be talking about also with Oregon.
Absolutely.
I think the you pointed up a challenge that's very real. One being to convey a positive message and tell the story of what is right in Oregon schools, because I think you're right. People like to back a winner. They don't like to put money into a loser. And we don't do ourselves any good when we, I think the phrase we heard yesterday and apt today, we don't do ourselves any good when we talk down our own stock. By the same token, you have to balance that message against the reality, which is we are a system, we have an education system that's under challenge.
Absolutely.
And so that the message isn't then one of complacency, but that we still have issues that we need to deal with. And I think Representative Farr may have touched it where that balance point is. Are we still telling stories of the success of the system that is phasing out, and do we have something less successful on the horizon if we don't make some changes now? And it came home to me yesterday, that conversation at my law office. A fellow came in, just a upstanding community leader who's been a one of the leaders of our youth activities program in Dallas for years, whose son graduated from Dallas High School a few years ago and got into an Ivy League school in a physics program or something, or just something monumental in terms of his accomplishments. And this fellow tells me that, in fact, he was in to see me, he's looking at a business opportunity up in Washington because he's got a daughter, I think, in eighth grade, and he's very concerned that her diploma will not carry the value that her brothers did when he graduated from high school. And he's looking at the retrenchment in the Dallas curriculum for next year to accommodate the lower funding level. And, you know, it's a very real concern for him. And I was struck. I've never heard that expressed so directly by somebody who is just the kind of person that, you know, that we want to keep in this state and our community. And it was his concern about the schools that is causing him to take this business opportunity out of state because he thinks his daughter will fare better there than what he sees for the future here. So that's the challenge, to maintain a positive message, to say that we're doing well under difficult circumstances, but that we also have challenges ahead that we have to step up and face and deal with forthrightly and soon, or things may not be so successful in the years to come. So I appreciate your conveying that to us, and we will be cognizant of that message as well. And I think it is important that we not talk down our own stock and say how bad things are in schools, because things are doing. We are doing well. We just need to be realistic that as we see in prospectuses when we get them from our investment advisors, you know, the warning that past performance is no guarantee of future returns, and we've got to maintain a focus on what will keep the future returns up and just as favorable as what we've seen in the past. Okay, that's my sermon, Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My sermon, too. Trying to tie together a couple of the things, and I don't want to get into the chicken and the egg and who's sitting and who's pushing up the hill did yesterday. But tying on to what Representative Berger said in regard to 10, 15 years ago, and we did have the naysayers then, there's no doubt about it. But I believe that a lot of that naysaying, and some since then, has been based on the kids and the parents of the kids whom we did not serve well. We left a lot of kids behind then, and quite often, I think probably most of us in this room had good experiences, were somewhat positive of the public school system. Then we put in high standards, and we were working very, very hard, and the whole thing, leave no child behind. We may find fault with that, but on the other hand, there is a real good message there. Wow. All kids deserve to be taught, and we should be teaching all kids, and we, in fact, have focused on that. I think the crisis that we're in now compounds on the earlier one. We would have been able to bring along the naysayers
as they experience success. But what we're in now, and I think your example is very good, Mr. Chair, we're dealing with people like your example and those of us sitting in this room who all of a sudden are saying, wait a minute, there's something really, really wrong here. And it's not just, it's certainly not because we had bad experiences. It's because we are cutting days off of the school year. We are doing things that are quite catastrophic. And I'm very concerned that a PR campaign might have worked a few years ago when we were looking at trying to improve things and educate all kids. And I don't think a public relations campaign will be wasted, but I want to get to the heart of this. It is money so that we can afford to have 180-plus days of school per year with class sizes less than 40 and offering a varied curriculum that is good not only for our college-bound and our SAT takers, but for all of our kids. And I just really get passionate, obviously, since it's my field. On the other hand, I fault us a tiny bit because we were somewhat closed-minded 10, 15 years ago. And I'm not sure we didn't cry wolf. I can remember this funding thing has been going on forever. Ozzie and I go back 100 years to where it was changed from 30-70 way to 70-30 the other way. But we were still crying then. And that probably hurts us a little bit because now we're crying and it's one of those, did we cry wolf? But we have to find a way to make sure people understand. My sermon, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Scott, let's pick you up.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate you coming. And although I don't share exactly your same thoughts, I think the school is extremely important to us, and I want to do all things that we can do. However, I don't feel, and I can't, I sat here and listened, and I can't just necessarily agree that adding additional money to our budget is going to go directly to the schools and therefore fund them in a direct manner unless it's dedicated. And I don't know that I can sit here and acknowledge that the proposals that you made are certainly are real and that they're offered. But you know, I think that we need to look at all of our aspects of it, and I think carrying on with what the other representatives have said, there was a time that schools did not look at it in the same light and that they asked for different amounts. Education is extremely important, and it's a strong economic development for our state, and we certainly need to recognize that. I think we also need to play in all of the other items that go along with that and really take a look at whether they are or are not in the appropriate direction for us to get the funding for our schools. Also, I think that in fairness, you know, we have to look at our costs and what our costs are. And I certainly would be in the camp that says, and I'll say it publicly if I haven't before, that I think educators, for the most part, are underpaid. I also think that educators have to look at what direction they put their total amount of their resources and what they ask for that to be done and where they go. You know, if you look at the PERS that you went over in a rather light method here you know, our cost to that, you know, that's a huge percentage of our cost in schools. And we need to look at that and see if it's the appropriate thing that we invest our money in. Should we move some of that to salary? Should we move some of it someplace else? I think there's a lot of thought that needs to go into it. I don't think just putting money into the budget is going to solve this issue. I think that we need to find a direction that does resolve to whatever capabilities that we have to do that. But I don't think just adding money to our budget is the answer. And to that degree, I sat here and listened to the proposals, and the proposals have been offered to this entire body and state, I guess, as to how we're going to resolve this. And I'm sorry, but I just can't agree that just adding money to it resolves it.
Representative Farr.
Thank you. Just very briefly, Superintendent Castillo, most people in the building agree that Oregon's economic recovery has to be one of the things that we're clearly focused on right now. Over and over again, I hear testimony from business leaders and business representatives that a solid public school system is highly important to their investment in the state and in future business growth and in future job creation. Over and over again, and almost invariably, they state that that having a solid public education system is what attracts business to the state. That being said, when you look at this committee, you see four former school board members, you see a retired superintendent, you see three education committee members, including the two vice chairs, you see at least two former teachers, and I think that your requests and your statements, your testimony today, is in good hands with this committee. I think it's a well-designed, well-made-up committee, and you have nine sets of ears. Some of them absent right now, but nine sets of ears that will listen to what you have to say. Thank you once again.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, if I could just share something with the committee. I have put together a team of student advisors from around the state. There are 40-plus students that met for the first time last Friday. And it's a very diverse group of students from all over the state. We made sure that we were very geographically diverse in the makeup of this. It is an amazing group of students who are so excited to have been asked to be advisors to the superintendent. And one of the issues very much on their mind from day one when they got together last Friday was trying to help solve the school funding crisis that we have in our state. And they are going to be working in some subcommittees, doing some really good work. And one of the subcommittees is going to be looking at funding. So at some point, I would love to have them come before your committee and talk with you about ideas that they come up with and input that they have on their experience with their schools and the ideas that they come up with for how we can solve our school funding crisis.
Well, that'd be great. We'd be glad to have them.
All right.
Fun for them and fun for us to hear. So
thank you.
Yeah, let us know, and okay. We'll try to accommodate you on that schedule.
Did I comment on that, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
I was never smarter than when I was 16.
Yeah. I didn't say we'd let them vote. Brian, do you want to? You've got some things you want to go over with us, I assume. Is he going to be doing the numbers and the? We've got our small schools report and the ESD report.
Chair Federley, I am prepared to go over the two reports.
Yeah. Is somebody going to tell us what these mean? These are the we have numbers from the districts. Who brought this to us?
Oh, those are Mr. Chair. Those are from the database initiative.
Yeah.
Telling
okay.
you
right.
just,
so this
an example,
just an example of what's available. Okay.
What's available? Okay. Exactly.
Very good, Brian.
Mr. Chair,
I'm sorry.
I'm going to have to leave. I have a 10:30 appointment, so I apologize for not catching.
Well, I'm sorry, but we have 2.5 hours yet to go in the committee today.
Oh, we didn't.
No. Keeping up on our schedule of yesterday. No, thank you very much, Representative Farr. Brian, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Federley. For the record, I'm Brian Reeder with the School Finance Office at the Department of Education. I'm here today to present to you a summary of two studies that the department did last fall, both of which were required by the 01 legislature. I'd like to talk about this, what we've called the small school study first. This study was required by Senate Bill 519, and the intent was to get a better understanding of how the cost of running small schools and small districts differs from running the cost of larger schools and districts in Oregon. The charge of the legislation was to conduct a study on the relationship between the size of Oregon's small school districts and the cost and need for programs. And based on the study, the department shall develop recommendations about small school districts. Another part of that same bill set aside $9 million to be distributed to small high schools in Oregon, based on the recognition that it costs more to operate small schools than it does on a per-student basis than it does larger schools. So even though the statement, the charge referred specifically to small districts, we looked at both district size and school size and their impacts on the cost per student. The study really had four objectives. The first was to develop an understanding of the resource needs of small schools and districts and how they differ from larger schools and districts. And the second was to distinguish between the effects on costs of small district size as opposed to small school size. And the reason those are different is that the forces that influence district-level costs and school-level costs as they relate to size are very different. So we wanted to really look at both aspects. The third objective was to evaluate how well the small school correction that currently is part of Oregon's funding formula works. Is it really directing the proper level of resources to small schools? And the fourth was to develop recommendations to improve the efficiency of small districts and schools in Oregon. In doing the study, we took a three-part approach, sort of three aspects of how we approached the study. I think they complement each other fairly well. The first was to conduct interviews with superintendents, principals, business managers of small schools and small school districts in Oregon, and much of that occurred at a small school conference that was held in Pendleton in the summer of 2002. The second approach was to develop some small school prototypes similar to the prototypes that are part of the quality education model. Those are sort of hypothetical schools that have a great deal of detail on the resources that are needed to run a school effectively. The prototypes in the quality ed model are the sizes of those are sort of intermediate size schools. The high school is 1,000 students, the middle school is 500, and the elementary school is 340. But very clearly those, we have quite a few schools in Oregon that are much smaller than those sizes. We have high schools that have on the order of 50 to 100 students, elementary schools that are even much smaller than that. So we wanted to develop a prototype that more accurately captured the cost situation faced by those smaller schools. And then the third approach was something that's relatively new, statistical approach that has been used by the education community and particularly by economists to try to isolate the factors that influence the costs of developing an education to students. And so we developed what's called a cost function that tries to isolate which aspects of a school influence its costs, at the same time taking into account student performance. One of the biggest problems we have in evaluating school costs is that they spend the amount of money that we give them. So if we give them a lot, then they spend a lot. If we give them a little, they spend a little. It's really not correct to say that's what their costs are. That's their spending. And unless you have some measure of their output, then you really don't have a true view of what their costs are. So this approach takes into account both what they spend and what they produce. And what they produce is student learning. And in the case here, we use a couple of different measures. For high schools, we look at SAT scores. And for elementary schools, we look at percentage of students meeting the state benchmarks in both third and fifth grade. What we found was, and this won't be surprising to anyone, that very small schools cost quite a bit more to operate than larger schools. And what we find, and I think if you have the report in front of you, it's instructive to look at sort of the relationship between school size and cost per student. On page 16, you'll find a graph that shows that relationship for high schools. And what it shows is at very small sizes, the cost per student is extremely high, over $20,000. But it falls very rapidly, and down when you get down to a high school size of around 300 to 400, those costs flatten out and stay flat. Actually, when you get out to about 1,800 students, they start to creep up again, which says to me that very large high schools have some diseconomies of scale in them, that as you get larger and larger, there are things that go on in high schools that do not help promote student learning and may actually diminish the ability of students to learn.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Thank you. Brian, on this particular chart on page 16, it says that it excludes transportation and ESD costs. if those were factored in, would not the cost for the smaller units be even much higher?
Chair Shetterly, Representative Hobson, I think that's correct. The reason that we left transportation costs out is that they are a function primarily of geographic circumstances, not size of school.
But the correlation
schools
are in the rural parts of the state.
The correlation is quite high, but we do have cases where we have small schools that have quite low transportation costs because their students are even though they're small, they're concentrated close to the school. So in order to take out the effects of that geography and really focus only on the size issue, we left those out.
Follow up, Mr. Chair? Right, I certainly appreciate that. And in regard to the ESD costs, is it not true that some of these small rural ESDs do in fact flow through $500 to $1,000 per student as opposed to Multnomah, which of course does not and cannot do that?
Representative Hobson, those monies are in here. The only ESD expenditures that are excluded are the administrative expenditures. So all the flow through and all the value of the services that ESDs provide to districts are in here. So that in that sense, it's a comprehensive look.
Thank you.
We find a similar kind of relationship for elementary schools that graph is shown on page 23. And again, at very small school sizes, the costs are quite high, although not nearly as high as for high schools. And then they flatten out at school sizes of around 150 to 200 students. And in the case of elementary schools, they continue to fall over the range shown here. Now, we have in Oregon, we have some extremely large high schools on the order of 2,200, 2,400 students. We don't have what I would consider extremely large elementary schools. 800 students in an elementary school is considered quite large, but in comparison to a high school, it's not. So we don't see the turn up at the larger sizes that we saw in high schools, and I think that's because we don't really have elementary schools that are way out in that extreme.
Representative Bridger.
Brian, with their closing schools, however, like in my district, they're putting all of them into one, like 7th, 8th grade, or all in one school. So those schools have, really increased in populations where they wouldn't have been otherwise.
Chair Federley, Representative Verger, one thing that we didn't look at here was combined schools, say, for example, K through 8 schools or 7 through 12 schools, because they're a bit of a different animal. We also didn't focus on middle schools because we don't really have small middle schools in Oregon. If you have a relatively small middle school population, then you don't create a small middle school. What you do is you create a K through 8 or a you put the middle school students either in the elementary school and make a combined school, or make a combined middle high school, so you don't have a standalone small middle school. But you're correct, we're in our efforts to save money, and when that involves closing schools, very often it will involve creating these combined schools or making those combined schools larger. The next thing we looked at, and I'll just touch on it briefly, although it's a relatively important finding, although we don't develop it in a great level of detail here, is that it has to do with transportation costs, and that is that some of these small schools and small districts, although we don't have school-level transportation cost information, but when you look at small district transportation costs, there's a very clear correlation between district size and cost or spending per student on transportation. And what we found is that even with a 70% reimbursement from the state, that 30% that the district is responsible for itself is quite large in some of these districts. We have some districts that spend well over $1,500 per student in transportation, and the 30% that the district has to pay itself of that is still can sort of draw money away from the classroom. And there is a bill, I believe, Senate Bill 550, that addresses that question to try to increase the reimbursement rate for those districts that have extremely high transportation costs. We also took a look at how these cost estimates based on size relate to the small school correction that we have in the school funding formula, and I've got comparisons in here. We need to back up a little bit in the report.
Page 18.
Probably read this more recently than I have.
Oh.
Yes, page 18 for high schools shows the cost curve that we looked at earlier, along with how much the small school correction directs towards those schools of that size, and what we find is that they are very close to each other. And I conclude from that the small school correction is doing a very good job of directing the proper amount of resources to high schools of small size. Similar curve for elementary schools. Page 24. Here, the closeness of the two curves is not they're not quite as close as they are for high schools. The small school correction appears to be directing more money to these schools than this cost function estimate suggests they really need. Keep in mind, though, again, that transportation costs are not in the numbers used to develop the cost curve. To the extent that these districts have higher transportation costs, then one view of this may be that those added resources to the small school correction compensate for that. One recommendation of the study is that we try to separate the two pieces, the additional resources for smallness be separate from the additional resources for high transportation costs, so that we can get a better fit for those two. They really are driven by different things, and trying to compensate for both of them through the small school correction, we may not be hitting the mark as closely as we could if we separated
them. Does Senate Bill 550 help us get there?
It does in one sense, in that it gives more money to the very high transportation cost districts. It doesn't make any change to the small school correction. So in that sense, it doesn't take us all the way there. Keep in mind, though, that the fact that the small school correction curve is above the cost curve doesn't mean that we're giving them enough money. It means relative to what we're giving to larger schools, we're directing the right proportion to them, but not necessarily the right absolute amount.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Brian, where do the costs for boarding for the schools that have boarding facilities, is that included within the transportation costs?
Chair Federley, Representative Hobson, those schools do report very high transportation costs, and we reimburse them for their boarding expenses as though they were transportation costs. So that's the mechanism that is used to, we treat those boardings those boarding costs as a substitute for the transportation costs they would have to incur if they didn't board their students. So we treat them the same way, yes. Those particular schools were excluded from this analysis because they truly are unusual circumstances.
Mr. Chair?
Yes?
Follow up on that. So that would mean that the transportation costs would really be increased for those smaller schools if we included the boarding costs, which do come out of that.
fund.
That's correct. That's correct. A final point about sort of small school size and small district size in general, and I think Representative Verger touched on this. One of the recommendations which has come from a lot of different areas is, well, there's a lot of cost savings to be had by consolidating districts or consolidating schools. As I mentioned earlier, we also looked at the effects of district size on costs. If you look on page 25, we have the relationship there between district size and per student costs. The independent effect of district size aside from school size. And what this shows is that at very, very small districts, those costs are higher, and those are primarily fixed costs of superintendents and their staffs. But as you get up to about 3,000 or 4,000 students in a district, those costs flatten out again. And there really are very little cost savings to be had from consolidating districts. The real cost savings are to be had from creating fewer but larger schools. Having said that, though, one thing that became very clear from my discussions with school people in those small districts is that, particularly for high schools, the school represents a key component of sort of the social cohesion, the identity of many communities in our state, particularly the small communities. And in order to save on out-of-pocket or financial costs, the consolidation of schools really involves closing at least one school if you're going to combine two schools. That has a couple of consequences. First, you have to transport some students further than they've been transported before, so your transportation costs go up. But also, one community loses its school, and in that sense, there may be some very significant social costs that aren't considered simply by looking at the per student.
Do you know of the 190 some odd school districts around the state, how many are below where that line flattens out, wherever that number is, 2,500, 3,000, how many? As a percentage, it's going to be a pretty sizable share of the districts, isn't it?
37, 18, 8.
It is. It's in terms of the number of districts, it's a sizable percentage. In terms of the number of students served,
right,
it's quite small.
Right.
But you're right. We have a lot of small districts in Oregon. And finally, the recommendations that we developed out of this study, none of them very earth-shattering.
That's good.
One thing that came out of my discussions with districts, again, was that their ESDs are trying to do more and more to help them keep their costs down, and some of the things they're doing is cooperative purchasing agreements where they can buy certain things, textbooks, supplies, even food for their food service programs. If they can get together and buy them in larger quantities, they can keep their costs down. If they can, you know, much of that has to be transported to the eastern part of the state for many of those small districts from Portland or from Eugene or from Salem, and those transportation costs can be high, and by consolidating their purchases, they can help keep those costs down. As I mentioned earlier, try to sort of adjust the small school correction to be solely an adjustment for size, and try to treat the transportation issue separately, because they really are driven by different things. Work with the Quality Ed Commission to get a better understanding of small school costs and to further develop the small school prototypes. That's been one of the criticisms of the Quality Ed model, is that it doesn't address the situation faced by small schools.
Okay.
And we have a start on developing those prototypes now that came out of this study. And then, of course, a critical piece of in the equity discussions among schools of different sizes is that the weights in our formula be accurate. In talking about the size issue, the small school correction being the critical one. But in general, not only for issues of size, but equity issues relating to special ed, English language learners, the other aspects that we know increase the cost of providing services to students, that those weights be evaluated to make sure that they are at the appropriate levels.
Well, I appreciate that. Is that it on the small school study then?
Yes.
Okay. You know, we have, Paul, Senate Bill 550 is moving to the floor over there, so we'll be getting that soon enough. That deals with transportation and special ed. And then, of course, we'll be doing the formula eventually, too, and we can take a look at the small school correction and the transportation costs all together then at some point and work with you and maybe with Ozzie Rose and others who have some battle scars from the small school correction war from the previous sessions and see if there are some adjustments that we can use this study to guide us forward. Brian, did you want to touch on the ESD report? We do need to be done by 11, so we've got 15 minutes.
Yeah, I'll try to move through this very quickly. This is the report the Oregonian described as dry and technical, so I'll I may
okay,
get up and dance a little to liven things up, if that would help.
Well, your presentation is making up for what?
Mr. Chair, is that by implication that the last report we just went through was not dry and technical? Is that
is this a relative thing?
Brian smiled.
It won't come.
First time.
Coming out of Senate Bill 260 in the 01 session was a requirement to evaluate ESD services in the state and to identify where deficiencies exist around the state in the services offered by both ESDs and districts. The attempt here was to sort of marry the services that ESDs provide with those that the districts they serve provide to get a sort of a comprehensive view of the services available to students, rather than simply looking at districts in isolation over here and ESDs in isolation over here. Try to bring those two things together and talk about them in the same way. Talk about the resources as a whole rather than as separate. In order to do that, the legislation charged us with developing a comparable definition of services across ESDs and districts, to create a catalog of those services and try to tie those to a chart of accounts so that we can have some cost information or some spending information on those services, and then finally to identify where in the state there are deficiencies. We started out by reviewing the previous studies done on ESDs, which really developed lists of services that ESDs provide, but really didn't gather any data on spending or level of resources devoted to providing those services. Those lists of services were quite long. I believe well over 250 separate services were identified that ESDs provide to districts, but without any data on sort of what level of services they provided or how much they spent on them, those lists didn't really provide much guidance in evaluating how well ESDs were serving their districts. It became fairly clear to us in going through this, if we were going to tie services to a chart of accounts, what we really needed to do was use our chart of accounts as the list of services, because the chart of accounts the department uses now, which is the basis for the data collected for the database initiative, provides a lot of detail on the activities that districts and ESDs spend their money on and sort of the items they purchase. The activities are what we call functions. They would be things like instruction, transportation, special ed services, so forth. The things they buy with their resources are what we call objects, and those would be salaries, supplies, in particular, in the transportation area, you know, what percentage of its salaries versus fuel and things like that. So on the one hand, functions are what you do and objects are what you buy. The list of services that we develop that's consistent with the chart of accounts is on the functional side, what it is you do with the money, what are the activities that you do. So we ended up concluding that the very long list of services developed in the prior studies didn't give us any guidance, particularly in trying to develop consistent ones between ESDs and districts. Those lists apply to ESDs but not districts. They're really the only place we find consistent definitions are in the chart of accounts that the department currently uses. So it was an obvious choice as a basis for evaluating the services that both districts and ESDs provide. And it has the advantages that we've been collecting data that way for a number of years, and particularly in the last 4 or 5 years through the DBI, collecting that data electronically and spending a fair amount of effort making sure it's accurate and consistent over time. Using the information that we have in the database initiative, the next challenge was to evaluate where deficiencies in services exist in the state. Keeping in mind that the bill did not define what deficiency means. That was left to the department. And that's a difficult thing to do. There are really two views you can take. And the first is relative deficiencies. That is, do some districts and ESDs have more resources than others? It's an equity question. And the other view is, do they have enough to do what we think they ought to be able to do? And that's sort of an adequacy question. We looked at the equity question first, and those really are where the striking conclusions are to be found. What we've done in Oregon post-Measure 5 is equalize resources per weighted student for districts, but we haven't done that for ESDs. We are, up until a few years ago when we started phasing in a new funding formula for ESDs that is based on weighted students, the funding to ESDs was based on the historical circumstance prior to Measure 5, and there were great disparities prior to Measure 5 simply based on the way ESDs and districts chose to fund themselves.
Brian, I have a question. Representative Bridger.
Why are we looking at 99 to 2000?
Chair Federley, Representative Verger, when we began this study, that was the latest year of data available to us. Keep in mind that all of this data is at a very detailed level, and it is based on the audited expenditures of school districts and ESDs. At the end of the school year, their auditors come in, do the audit, and then they send the data to us. And we spend a couple of months reconciling any differences we find between their paper audit and their electronic data. So, for example, right now we are in the process of finalizing the 0102 data. So we're essentially a full year behind when we get the data. And when we started this process back in 02, in the summer of 02, actually earlier than that, in the winter of 01-02, the 99-2000 data was the latest available.
Okay.
What we find in looking at per ADMW expenditures for school districts, we're essentially flat. They're the same everywhere in Oregon. That's a function of the way we fund schools through our formula. the goal of the formula, which we have achieved, is to give every district the same amount of money per weighted student, with only small variations for differences in transportation costs and teacher experience. For ESDs, we find that when you express it on a weighted student basis, there is still a great deal of variation, and our conclusion from that is that that represents an inequity in our financing system. Some students have more resources available to them simply because their ESDs have a lot more money than the ESDs in other areas. And if our formula is accurate in directing resources to where the costs truly are, then that represents an inequity. But that inequity will be essentially erased once the current ESD formula is fully phased in. So in that sense, we don't see any compelling equity problems that remain with the way we fund ESDs once their formula is phased in. We don't see any relative deficiencies existing after that.
So we stay the course.
We stay the course.
Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Brian is being very tactful in this. The Oregonian may have said this was a very dry report. I can guarantee you that some of the interactions at some of the meetings were anything but dry. They were quite spirited. When you have an ESD receiving $2,000 per kid, and you have a number of ESDs receiving $150 per kid, the inequity was rather apparent.
The other view of service deficiency is from the adequacy viewpoint, and I think the very issue that Superintendent Castillo touched on this morning is we simply don't have enough money for schools in Oregon. And in that sense, every district and every ESD has a deficiency right now from an adequacy perspective.
Brian, were there any recommendations coming out of the study that are either in legislation or that... it's one thing to stay the course on the progress toward equalization. Are there some mid-course changes that we need to be aware of?
Chair Shetterly, no. The primary recommendation that came out of it was to stay the course on implementing the ESD formula. The other was, and it is identical to the one from the small school study, is that the equity of our system really depends on the weights in the formula being true reflections of cost, and that we really do need to review those. They have not been reviewed since they were put in place.
They've been reviewed, just not changed. I mean, we get probably 20 bills every session to change the formula, and we look at some of them, and we always tiptoe to the brink, and then we tiptoe back.
Well, Chair Federally, when I say they haven't been reviewed, they certainly have been looked at, but I do not think they have been studied in any systematic way.
Yeah, I imagine that's true. Anything else, Brian? We need to wind this up.
I think that's it.
Okay. Anything else, committee? If not, thank you, everybody. I want to congratulate our four survivors out there. Richard, of course, is late to the island. glad to have you.
We can go over it again.
I'm so glad you all brought your PDFs that you worked on here during the meeting. Brian, thank you for your presentation of these reports. Committee, we are adjourned for the weekend.